Hey, you guys, welcome back to another episode of the Good Grow Great podcast. I'm Talia Toha, and this is 6 Degrees of Greatness. Today, we're sitting down with Mark Thomas and Ashley Caldwell. Mark is the co-founder of several e-commerce brands and labels, including two in the outdoor lifestyle space, like Wildhorn Outfitters, which you guys totally should check out. They've also generated nearly $40 million since they began in 2015. So we are going to be talking about how he grew these brands over the course of the years, and definitely listen to some of the key gems that he shared with us. Ashley Caldwell, also here today, is a three-time Olympian and 2017 world champion in aerial ski. She spent 12 years in the U.S. aerials team and is also part of the Elite Aerial Development Program. She's known as the world's only female who has ever landed the daddy, a quadruple twisting triple backflip. Get this though, even with all that, she hates the cold, which I thought is just absolutely amazing. Now, Mark is also going to be diving into why there is no such thing as a good idea. This is interesting. And also the anatomy of decision-making that can make or break your business. Also, what seasoned leaders know about how to react to challenges, and also top habits to stay sane, centered, have fun, and clear your mind. And Ashley is going to be talking with us also about how she became the only woman ever to have nailed the daddy. And she's going to be taking us through the step-by-step process that led her to holding that world record, right, for the hardest acrobatic trick ever landed by a female. And also what it really takes for her to overcome epic fails, hating the cold, unexpected circumstances, high stakes performance, and how to stay calm and reverse engineer her success and how you can do the same. Before we dive into all of that, though, you guys, be sure to hit follow, subscribe, add, or collect. Let's dive in. All right, you guys, welcome to the podcast. And I'm so excited to sit down and chat with you guys. And I wanted to actually start with you, Mark, because you have this fantastic company. And but before we kind of dive into what you guys do right now, I wanted to kind of take us back to when you started the whole thing, right? And I was actually listening to something online where the president and I guess the former founder of Netflix, he was saying how there's no such thing as a good idea, right? Everything kind of started out as a bad idea. And I'm kind of curious to hear if in the early stages of your brand, whether there were kind of moments when you kind of play that off with somebody that you're working with, or perhaps a future partner or now your partner, where you kind of go, oh, you know what, this would be an awesome idea. And then whatever it is that you guys were thinking at the time, it was not even close to what you have right now, right? Was there any moment like that when, like years back when you were just starting out?
Yeah, so we started 6 years ago, not to the date, but we started back in 2015. And originally the idea was that, you know, we'd find a couple of products that could make a few dollars a day on Amazon, just private label. We didn't care about the industry. We didn't care about the category. And so the first bright idea that we had was, okay, we're going to import this Japanese kendama. And kendamas were really big back in 2015. And I don't know if they still are today, or I don't think they are as popular today, but it's this wooden cup and ball toy, basically. And we hadn't really started anything in the business. That was our idea. We were on the verge of placing the PO for these Japanese toys. And we went to lunch with some people who were in the same sort of startup phase of their Amazon business. And there was four of us sitting down at the table, and we asked everybody, okay, so, you know, like, what are you going to do? What are you going to sell? And this one guy gets this look in his eye, and he's got this great idea. He's like, I'm going to do kendamas. I looked at my business partner, who's actually my brother too. And I was like, uh-oh. And we asked him how many he ordered. He's like, oh, I got 10,000 of these kendamas coming. And so we just completely killed the idea and moved on to the next thing. And the genesis story of the brand actually becomes quite more interesting later on. But I'm really glad that we pulled the ripcord on that idea. And of course, now we are a thriving, growing outdoor lifestyle company that obviously doesn't do toys. You know, so there's a lot of moments like that, though. And even today, I mean, we have ideas today that are terrible and others that are great. But I think that quote about there's no such thing as a good idea, I think the relevancy to that is the only thing that matters is execution. And whether an idea is good or bad is somewhat irrelevant. What is relevant is the execution of the idea. And most of us, you know, struggle with that point. And so if you're good at execution, I think you can take most ideas and make them viable.
Yeah. So how do you then kind of transform for the audience who's listening, right? And they're constantly playing with all these like terrible ideas and whatever it is, their crappy first drafts. How do you then, you know, go and bridge that bad idea to, you know, what would eventually become a decent idea? Do you feel like the evolution is necessary? Like the process is something that is almost like a necessary evil? Or do you feel like even just from your Kendama experience that has to be killed instantly and then we have to jump straight into this new thing? Is there such a thing as that that kind of weaving kind of evolution, do you think?
I do think there is a necessary evil in failure and in going through a process for you, because the minute you start the game, the variables change. And there's a lot of self-help books, there's a lot of podcasts, and now you can go on Clubhouse and you can listen to all these people talk about, you know, their model for success. But there's just everything's so dynamic and everybody's journey is so different. And so for me, I think you have to have at least a valid hypothesis. Like you have to at least identify, okay, I think the market is going to like this because of XYZ. And I think the market is big enough, and I'm obviously limiting this to just commerce, but I think the market is at least big enough to build the business I want to build. And you could be wrong on those questions, but you at least have to have those questions and some answers that have some validity to them. And then from there, it's like, okay, step one, I'm going to start, and I'm going to, once that domino is pushed down, once you spent some money on, or once the expenses start to pile up, I think in entrepreneurship, the most important step is just the first one, which is stop visiting the forums,
the books,
stop wasting your time on Clubhouse and the books and this, that, and the other, and just go tip over the first domino. And then all of that other advice that's out in the universe, you'll be able to know what's applicable to you and what isn't.
Yeah. So focusing on the actions, right, rather than the ideation, which I'm loving already. And I'm kind of curious, Ashley, in your coming into this world of aerial ski, because you started out not in that world, right? Did you feel that when you were starting that out, that there was resistance? Did you feel like that was something that, you know, like what Mark was saying, that, you know, you have to sort of, work out and just kind of, okay, process of elimination. This is not going to work out. I'm not going to do this. I'm going to focus on maybe the daddy, like you were saying. Do you feel like there was something like that? Or was it more kind of like, you know what, I'm just going to try things out and just trial and error it?
Well, I definitely resonate with the idea that freestyle skiing might be an originally bad idea that you can turn into a good idea. I started the sport when I was 13 or 14 years old, and my mom and I and dad had been originally watching the Olympics and said, it would be a good idea if you go do aerials. And so that's a bad idea my mom had, telling her 12-year-old daughter to go do triple backflips. Yeah. It turned out to be a good idea. I'm heading into my fourth Olympic game, so she knew something about me I didn't know at the time. But in aerials, we are a very progression-oriented sport. And so you start with one backflip, and then you add a twist, and then you do another backflip, and you add a twist, and you like keep going until you can't go anymore. And I have hit that point. No girl had successfully completed a floatable full, the daddy. And I just, you know, I wanted to get there, get to the top. And there is resistance in everything you do. Like my body's resisting what I do, gravity. You know, there's people that don't believe in you. There's people that do believe in you. And there's like, so I would definitely agree with the idea that you just have to keep going through the steps. I think something that I would also say is sometimes those steps don't necessarily seem clear or seem like it's sometimes hard to keep taking those steps. It's so having people around you to like help motivate you and give you good ideas and like keep pushing you to tell you like you got to, you know, keep doing those things is definitely helpful. So I think maybe in the business world, like that's where some people definitely struggle. Like Mark, you said, you just have to keep tipping dominoes over. But sometimes when the dominoes keep not doing the next domino, you know, like you crash 17 times in a row on snow, you definitely have to have people around you that want to keep helping you push, even though it doesn't seem like any of those dominoes are working. So I think that I would relate that to business for sure.
Yeah. Can I ask you, and this is personal curiosity, because I'm trying to kind of understand a little bit more about why, and I can understand that it's very difficult to accomplish, right? That move that you just so beautifully did and have mastered, right? And is there a reason why that hasn't been a regular, almost canon, right, as part of the women's aerial ski Olympics? Is there a reason particularly in your mind, or is it just because of, I don't know, customs, like people just don't do it?
Yeah, I would say that I don't have it down yet. I've only done that trick a handful of times and just at the right times and with the right success rate. But triple backflips are extremely hard. And in women's aerials, there just aren't a lot of athletes that are doing such hard tricks. So that risk ratio is, risk reward ratio is a little bit higher. So every time you go out and do a double backflip, like my landing percentage in doubles is extremely high. But in triples, it's a lot lower. So if I go into a competition and there's only like two or three girls doing triples, there's a good chance that both of us fall and then doubles wins. And so sometimes that pushes girls to stay on the double because it just has that reward factor with less risk. That's not always the case. Sometimes there's 10 girls at the Olympic year. There'll be 10 girls up there on the triple, and you'll have to do a triple in order to you know, get on the podium and be really successful. So sometimes it's you got to look at like, really, what do you want to do in the next 4 years? And what do you want your stamp on your athletic career to be? Like mine's always been, I'd rather push myself the hardest I possibly can and potentially be last place, but also be ready to like go win every event. And so that's kind of been my motto, and I've stuck to it, you know, barring injuries or, you know, crazy conditions. But, that's why I push myself, but that's also why the sport you don't necessarily see that same standard, that the guys, like the reason they call that trick the daddy is because that once, like all the men do that trick, like yeah. It's your stock trick. It's the daddy trick. You just do it. And girls just haven't reached that level in our sport.
Yeah. Do you have a moment where, I guess somebody had mentioned, oh no, you shouldn't do the daddy. You should just focus on the doubles, you know, and even maybe professionally, maybe a coach or something or a colleague. And what did you say to them, or what's going through in your mindset as far as kind of getting you past that and continuing on with what you feel like you're compelled to do?
Yeah. A lot of people have suggested that like, I just back it down, because you do see much easier tricks get on the podium very regularly. But I just don't want to do that. This sport is like incredibly scary. We go to a lot of really harsh places, and like, I'm here to like prove myself and do like be my best. And there's been a lot of times if I backed down, I probably would have won the event, gotten a podium. And I had a hard time doing that. And in my older age, it's changing a little bit. I have a more strategy, like I want to go win the Olympics. And so sometimes I back down in other competitions because I'm like, you know, this is my goal. This is my end goal. And so that's changed a little bit in my years of experience, but just why I'm here is to push myself as hard as I can.
Yeah, I love this. Well, and I love that you're kind of going through that path with most resistance almost, which, and almost like looking more from the long-term aspect of it. Like what you were saying, what do I want to leave behind with the sport rather than just, oh, that quick win. I could totally do the double, but I'd rather do this thing because it's going to, maybe perhaps make us proud, right? You're doing something for the sport. And I want to go back to Mark real quick. When you're kind of in those early phases of your business and growing your brands, were there moments when you had to choose, there were decisions where you go, oh, this is a long-term thing and this is a short-term thing. And I could do this easy thing, right? By doing this, whatever that is. But I'm going to choose the long-term, strategy. What were some of any examples that you can think of that you can share with the audience, Mark?
Yeah. So the first decision that we made probably 90 days into this process was that we wanted to build a brand, not a product. And there's a lot of ways to make money, especially selling online, where it's a short-term play. You have a product that has a cycle, it's short, and you are bouncing from product to product to product. And we originally thought that might be what we did. And so when our first outdoor product went viral, we started to realize that you had to build something that would outlast those cycles, those product cycles that are short term. And building a brand is really hard. It takes 10 years, you know, and I'm using an arbitrary number, but it's a long journey to build the team, the resources, the credibility, the trust, the innovation, and to do it over a period of years so that you can take your place inside of an industry that's been around for a long time. So I think that was an early decision we made and a really expensive one that has been, you know, the driver of most of our reinvestment. And 6 years in, I still feel like we're just getting started. And so if that's any indication of what the real long-term nature of this is, I don't know what else would be.
Yeah, I think you are right in that there seems to be a commonality in that 10 years is probably usually how long it takes. That's just how long it does take, right? And some people do it faster, some slower, but, you know, unless you're just not sleeping all day, it's really, you know, it takes a team and you kind of, you develop that team and you do all these things. But what I love actually with what you guys were just saying is that you both basically chose certain, decisions, right? When there's a fork in the road, you kind of went this way, which I actually love. But I am kind of curious, Mark, in your space, right? Was there like a moment, and again, for the audience who's listening, who's like down and are experiencing that roller coaster, right, with their business and their work, was there a moment when you felt like, perhaps that, okay, this really sucks, or it's going to be pretty hard to bounce back from this. Is there an example that come to mind?
Yeah. And unfortunately that still happens. I don't know if that goes away, you know, and I think Ashley could attest to that in her athletic journey as well, or career. I would say though, in the early days we had some, this was probably 4 or 5 months into the business. We were the victims of wire fraud and we lost, I don't know what the percentage of our total capital was, but it was probably like 30 or 40% of our capital was gone overnight. And we were 4 months old. And there was that moment where it felt like, okay, we tried to do everything right. We're making these long-term decisions. This still happened. How do we recover from this? And, you know, so that one sticks out as an early trial that I had to take a step back and just evaluate what do we do next? And, but there's no direction but forward when you're trying to build, And so, you know, we were able to overcome that. We were pretty fortunate that it happened right as sort of Q4 sales and started to pick up, and so we could grit through it. But it happens all the time, and that's and it's because we never complete. We're never a complete person. We're never a complete business. It's always an unfinished process. And to expect that my life is going to get any easier just because we've hit milestone XYZ, it's a false reality. It's not first principles thinking. And so to Ashley, going, you know, when Ashley was talking about her purpose was to go as hard as she can and to push herself as hard as she can. And I think that's true of all of us. And so if that's the path that you take, then it's just never going to get easier.
Yeah, well, yeah, absolutely. And I think we can all agree. And I mean, on the podcast, we talk about this a lot, right? Like going through it, just kind of seeing pain as part of the process in a lot of ways, physically, mentally, the whole thing. But speaking of pain, Mark, you mentioned, and is this true? You survived 8 concussions. Is this...
Yeah, I joke around. I say 8.5 because there's one in there that I'm not really sure about.
Okay,
that means it's full one.
Yeah, it might be there.
I was a little foggy, but yeah. So I used to be a wakeboarder. I used to also go big or go home, and unfortunately, that cost me a few times, and so I stopped wakeboarding when I was. I don't know. It's been a few years since I've been out on a board. I'd still get out and do it even now. I just have to really tone it down because 8 concussions is 7 too many. I mean,
yeah,
really,
I think you have more than me, and I do triple backflips.
Yeah, but I still think, you know, like you probably still hit your head more, and you just didn't get concussed, but.
Sure, that's what we're going with.
She falls better.
You
know,
here's the interesting thing. I was talking to a friend of mine last summer who is he's quite good. He has ridden more than a lot of most people that I know, and so he'd really perfected his skills, and he doesn't wear a helmet. And he actually told me that helmets are in wakeboarding, helmets help you protect your head from an inadvertent board, like coming out of your board and having that board slap you in the head. So here I was thinking, you know, I'm protecting myself from these concussions, and really what it was doing was probably increasing the chance of having them. So, but you know, most of them were pretty mild. One of them I went to the hospital for, but the rest of them were like, you know, I just needed to kind of sit in a dark room and stay awake and had symptoms for less, you know, a day or less.
Yeah. I wonder if this is something that, well, because I've seen and, you know, spoken to a lot of athletes, and it's almost like they're, because you guys train professionally, like every day you're doing this. So in a lot of, actually, in, if you really want to look at it, you're actually diminishing a lot of the risk, right? Because you actually know what you're doing versus just going out there and trying some stuff up, you know, and just kind of winging it, which I think I remember watching an interview with Alex Honnold, of course, and he was kind of asked the same questions, like, why are you maybe not afraid of death, or you're doing things that most people won't do, you know, and he kind of explained, similar to like what you were saying, you know, Mark and Ashley, like, okay, well, we train and we're just pushing ourselves like an inch at a time. And that's actually really the safest way to do it, right? So I like that. You know, you've had all these concussions, Mark, and you're powering.
You know, but here's the thing. I have all the concussions because I did just go out there and try stuff.
Okay.
Like, yeah. This
calculated
is why I have more than
different.
Like Ashley is, like, let's be clear. Ashley's a professional athlete. I am not. I am a novice who got addicted to the thrill and would try things and go bigger than was probably appropriate for my skill level, and I paid the price. But I do think there's something true about risk in general, where you can take really big risks that other people view as big risks, but We don't see it that way because we're prepared differently. We see the opportunity differently. We have different strategies, you know, so it's all relative. But I definitely was on a high risk, low reward spectrum with my with my short wakeboarding hobby. Yeah.
Was there a moment, you know, again, maybe years ago when you thought that whether that's wakeboarding or something else, that you were going to be full time, I'm totally going to do this, this is going to be my thing, you know, whether that's being an athlete or whatever, climbing for a living? Was there ever a moment when you thought that, you know what, I can do this?
I always have had a desire in myself to see if I can do something and to not really be satisfied with that curiosity until I either tried and failed or tried and actually succeeded. And probably going back to 2013, 2014, just before starting this business, I was working in a corporate job and I spent a lot of time thinking about how I didn't want to be in a corporate job and wondering if I could actually go and build something real and wondering if I can go challenge the universe and win. And that was a big reason why I ended up quitting that job before this had really taken off. And it was just a challenge I wanted to see, and I'm still fighting it. You know, I certainly don't feel like we've won. I don't feel like we've proven that we belong yet. So I'm in year six of this battle that I voluntarily jumped into. And I don't know, it's just something that for me is what was a driving force for me, you know?
Yeah, totally. Well, and speaking of like kind of battling on, Ashley, I wonder if, you know, when you started out, right? Because you mentioned that ski and jump on aerial ski, that wasn't really where you started. Was it gymnastics where you started?
Yep, gymnastics.
Okay, and when did that transition happen and how did that kind of come about?
The Olympics in 2006, I was 12 years old. And kind of my mom had planted that seed in my head. And my dad was such an avid skier that I think he liked the idea more than anybody. My daughter becomes a skier, that means I can ski more. And so they actually signed me up for summer camp. It just clicked. They were like, you have to be an aerialist. And I was like, I don't know, it's still pretty cold out here. you know, just camp after camp, doing backflips, getting snow up my back, landing, just being cold, being with a bunch of boys. I never competed with boys before. That was a lot. But I actually moved away from home at 14 and then was in the Olympics at 16. So those dominoes fell for me and I knew that that was like my path. But definitely have had my fair share of adversity through the years as well.
Yeah. Well, and you mentioned that you hated cold, right?
Which is don't like the cold. Like, I don't think people like that the cold brings snow. I don't know if they like being cold. I'm better prepared to be cold. Like, I wear the right equipment. But I don't, you know, it was negative 30 degrees in one of the last events we had and nobody was having that much fun.
Yeah. Did you feel that? Obviously now you're used to it, right? I don't know if you remember though, when you were starting out, and the reason why I asked this is because a lot of times people listen on the podcast, they're like, well, I want to do XYZ but I hate doing whatever, right? ABC, going back to what Mark is saying, it's like, okay, how can we become more of an executioner, right? Just more action based. So I'm kind of curious, when you were starting out, right, those camps and all of those things, do you remember having to kind of pull yourself out of bed maybe in the morning to just kind of go out there and kind of practice some of your jumps? And what are some things that kind of you have to maybe tell yourself perhaps to get yourself going?
Yeah. I mean, when you're, you know, when I got sent away, you did 14 or I voluntarily, obviously I didn't get sent away, but you know, you're, there's a bunch of people around you that are committing a lot of time and energy and effort for you. And you have to give it your all and you want to, and I just, you know, I wanted to see what I could do. So you just, you do get up, you go and train, and a lot of it isn't fun. Like, you don't always have fun. But you, those little reward moments push all those not fun moments, you know? So it's, I think one of my my biggest lessons throughout my career is being able to change my perspective based on how I'm feeling. When you're super excited and you just want to like, you just want to go, 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 your adrenaline, you're like, I want to win, win, win. Being able to shift that perspective back and be like, well, this might not be the best time to do that. And then also the ability to, you know, you're down in the dumps, you've just torn your second ACL after a year of doing rehab on your other ACL, and being able to like, look back at the big picture and say, hey, I'm still a year out from the Olympics. I can still do this. I've done it once. I've done it. I can do it again. So that perspective shift, I've learned over a lot of years. But I think it's one of my biggest attributes now is being able to zoom in on little things and taking the, like being able to be proud of really little things. And then, you know, coming back to the big picture and being able to motivate myself with that.
Because you just mentioned, you know, maybe when you tore your ACL and the other one actually had just recovered. And I'm kind of interested to hear more about your, I guess, take on that process of recovery, right? And I'm sure you have amazing people around you who shares all the medical stuff and all the good things that you should or should not be doing. But you personally, what's your philosophy on, because a lot of people are told sometimes, okay, you're going to be in the hospital bed for, you know, athletes or not, you're not going to be able to walk for whatever, forever. And then you hear all these stories of people being able to kind of, no, you know what? I'm going to do this and I'm going to walk off and they just do. So yeah. I'm kind of curious, where do you find that balance between, you know, proper rest, right? And giving your body the kind of recovery that it deserves, but also still pushing yourself. Like where is that kind of connective tissue for you?
They told me 6 months and you were just like, oh, well, I want to do it now. And then if you shift your perspective, you're like, wow, if I do this right now in a year, I won't be good. I might do this today, but I won't be able to walk for X amount longer. So you have to do it or you're going to wreck yourself. Like you have to be able to prioritize your goals and be able to see that you're accomplishing goals long-term in the short term. You have to go do these silly little wall slides for your knee and you do them every day. And in 1 month, you'll be way better than if you were like, no, I'm just going to go walk today. Like it's improper planning and perspective. And you learn that as an athlete. Some learn it a harder way than I did. Everyone, like people have surgeries as athletes, but you know, the smart ones do their rehab really well. And then they're stronger than the other people that are belligerent in their rehab and their rehab process. So I took everything I possibly could have out of my ACL rehab. I saw athletes before me win Olympic medals after going through ACL rehab. I saw other athletes not walk for 2 years because they were stupid when they were doing it. So taking that perspective it made my life a lot easier for sure.
Yeah, totally. Well, and I'm kind of curious about this, if we can expand on this perspective concept a little bit more and maybe this time with Mark, because I mean, I found that most people who want to do good things in their work, right, whether that's their career as an athlete or not, in business or whatever, they eventually develop different perspectives in different seasons, right? Perhaps in the earlier phase of most businesses, it's growth. You know, you still want to, it's a lot of the hustle, but then like kind of towards the middle stages of their business, it's a little bit more, okay, well, let's change it up a little bit. What's been the biggest difference for you, Mark, now that you're 6 years into this, as opposed to how you started things out earlier, that really kind of stood out as far as your approach to growing, your brand?
Yeah, it's actually really similar to Ashley's thoughts, because I think when I was younger and just getting started, I would react in an extreme way to an extreme problem. And whether that was, you know, the wire fraud issue or bad reviews or bad press or, you know, any number of issues that can happen, it felt like the world was coming down. It felt like, how do we survive this? How do we move forward? And now at this stage, we've survived so many of those fights that when the big things happen, I'm mostly just irritated. because it's like, okay,
it's happening again.
You know, all right, we got to, you know, a little bit of an, you know, you roll your eyes a little bit and then you roll up your sleeves and you get to work, because nothing will solve a problem like actually solving the problem. And I know that sounds a little bit cliche, but action again, and this theme will come up again and again, action will not only get you closer to solutions, but it will make you feel better too. And you will, you know, you won't stew. So now something will happen and I'll look at it and ask myself, is this a challenge? Is it an opportunity? Maybe it's an actual problem. Gather the information, work on a solution, move on. And so, you know, I'm calmer with those things now. But I still, there's still a little bit of drama in there. Like there's still,
something,
a little moment where I'm like, oh,
it's funny. We have the exact same thing happen. Like it's identical. Like the early athletes, the younger athletes, you know, they take a bad crash and they just are just so angry for so long. And like now in my career, like I give myself, so in the summertime, we jump into a pool and it's like, I give myself till I'm at the edge of the pool and I'm getting out, and you have emotion and like, you could be upset until then. And then it's over, it's go time. You gotta go do it again. And you gotta do it better next time. And like, it's the exact same thing. And you can see athletes in their career, their emotions, just they can handle them better. They process it better. And the ones that can't, they don't make it.
Mm.
Like their emotions that ruin them, being like not being able to like get it together and like actually go have a process that's going to fix and solve the problem. It's very, mm. very similar.
The reality is the world doesn't care how you feel.
True. Yeah.
Like, totally.
Nobody, yeah. You have a very small group of people who care about you in general, yeah. but also who are worried about your feelings. Like you just like you have to become, you know, you can't, we're human beings. And so we don't take emotion out of it, but you have to take your emotion and take it down to a controllable level as small as possible so that you're making good decisions that will benefit you and benefit the people that are around you. The minute that emotion is the reason you react to something, I can almost guarantee you a bad outcome 9 times out of 10.
Yeah. Someone was telling me, there's this quote that they heard about how like in your 20s, you know, you care a lot about what people, you know, think. And in your 40s, you realize that, you know, you don't care very much about what people think. And then in your 60s, you realize nobody cares about what you think. And I love what you're saying, Mark, with how, you know, there's just a very small fraction of people who actually care. And I think that's actually a good thing, you know, because like if our actions are so much determined by everyone's, you know, reactions, then it's just, I mean, it's a lot, it's so noisy, right? But Ashley, I'm kind of curious to hear what you would have done, like if, right, with the younger, if you can tell your younger self, right, and kind of going back to, okay, don't react too much, and Mark is saying, let's make it as small as possible. Is it an internal process for you where you do that on your own? Do you talk it out with other, like a good friend or something, and just vent it out? Or you know, you hit a tub of ice cream or whatever? Like, what's that granular level thing?
I mean,
that
I'm definitely telling my younger teammates. They don't necessarily like, maybe they hear me, but like probably not. They probably don't hear me, but I'm giving the advice to future generations. But I think what it comes down to is it's exhausting and it's unproductive. So I think you just naturally, if you want to get better, like you have to kind of cut those things out in order to survive in the sport. And I mean, it's tough too, because I tell myself all the time, like some of the like mental strategies that we use in sport to not ride those waves so much. Like I tell myself, like, I want to be at a 7. I don't want to be at a 4. I don't want to care not at all, but I don't want to care at a 10. It's because that's again, too exhausting. I want to be at a 7. And in some ways there's a lot of different things that you could be rating. Like, is it your emotion to be the best? Is it your sadness when you mess up? Like, so those emotions are going up and down, but you have to like combine them all together to be a 7. If I can do that, that's usually my best training, my best competitions. And those can be a mixture. It's like my anger level could be at a 9, but you know, like my energy level is lower, so I can't even be higher. So it's figuring out where you thrive the best. So it's not taking emotion fully out of it, but it's like harnessing the right level for you. Cause you know, if I didn't have emotion about going to do triple backflips, I wouldn't do them. They're way too scary. So if I didn't want to do it, I wasn't passionate about it, I would just, that I couldn't do it. I just like, I wouldn't turn my skis. I wouldn't put my ski boots on. It just wouldn't happen. So I think it's managing those emotions appropriately is what gets you through those higher levels into success.
The idea of finding that really kind of comfort zone, like sweet spot where you're still passionate about what you do, but your life is not dependent on it kind of thing, you know? I love this. And so I'm curious to hear, what do you do then if, let's say, just before showtime, right? And you're kind of walking up and it's that hour that you have to kind of perform, you have to do everything in your training is leading up to this. Is it the same kind of routine, or do you have, like, I know some people, you know, they eat certain foods, they sleep, you know, maybe this one, they listen to certain playlists or whatever. Do you have routines like that?
There's definitely some superstitious athletes out there that have a routine. I don't have, like, I mean, I warm up the same way every time just because that's what you have to do physically. But I mean, if I had a perfect routine, I'd be doing it every time and winning everything, but I don't. And, you know, everyone's trying to fight to figure out what works best for them. And that's why you train. And I don't have it down perfect, and I'm trying a little bit different things every time. And sometimes things that will work for me one week won't work the next. And so that's where you build your resiliency. That's where you overcome more adversity and you learn more about yourself. But yeah, I definitely don't have it down, and I'm definitely not superstitious, because I'm worried that if I get too superstitious and something, like, what happens, like, I'm superstitious and then it's Olympic comp day and, like, the one superstitious thing goes wrong. I'm worried about that. So I think I'm, like, superstitious about being superstitious. Like, I can't do it. It won't work. But yeah, I think one of my mottos is prepare to be unprepared. And I think that's true in everything. And if you get too set on one thing, it's just, yeah, you're setting yourself up, I think.
Yeah. And I'm kind of curious, you know, going to your point about, like, preparing for the unexpected, you know, and just kind of expecting the unexpected probably is a better way to say it. I know that with people who are passionate about their work, right, their career, and even business as well, like, they're like a super planner, right? And I don't know, Mark, if now you've gotten into some kind of groove with, like, your team, perhaps, like, you have, like, a certain framework, or do you kind of approach your leadership style from sort of more like an organic way and just kind of like, you know what comes, we're going to deal with the fires, and or are you kind of more, okay, here's the playbook, this is what we're going to do, or kind of a combination of the two?
There's a certain point in growth in a company where you have to transition to systems, and the leadership has to exercise humility and realize that they can't brute force it anymore. And I think a lot of startups have personalities inside of them who, because of their personality, they can just sort of force growth and get to a certain level. But we have grown to a place where we have to have a system, and we have to adhere to a management style. And so, yeah, we've actually implemented something called Traction. And Traction is I don't know if you've heard of it, but it's like the entrepreneurial operating system is how they frame it. And it's a way to conduct meetings. It's a way to set goals, and it's a way to hold each other accountable and to have a clear and concise vision for where the business is going. And so we adopted that at the end of 2019, and it was really important to us during COVID, because COVID was very disruptive and distracting. And so having a structure with which we operated was important. That being said, there's still some organic elements to it, and where we adapt, we change, we we say, we don't like this about Traxion, we're going to do it our way. And there's also the, you always have to stay a little bit adaptable to opportunities that you just can't plan for that show up, and be able to say, yes, we have to bring this in. And it just, you know, so at least, you know, that's the stage that we're in now. I think at some point we'll outgrow even that, hopefully.
Yeah. And I like, you know, I like that kind of reminder that, hey, yeah, for sure, at some point there needs to be like a system, because it just gets to a certain size that you can't, like, without it, it's just, you know, it's like a bundle of kind of fire, really. But I'm kind of curious to hear your take, Mark, on, you know, how do you, as a leader, right, of your team, I mean, you have this amazing team, and how do you, as a leader, for the audience who's listening, how do you approach your infinite goals, right, those long-term goals with your finite goals? I know that there is this school of thought that, oh, we're going to be very metric driven, right? The sales, the performance, the KPIs, the whole thing. But there's another school of thought that's like, no, we're going to focus on investing in our people, and the KPI kind of comes second, right? And the sales and the numbers all kind of come second. So what do you do to reconcile, you know, the two, and what do you kind of do to motivate your team to still kind of push that limit again, right? But still within the bounds of them feeling safe to be in your, you know, with the team?
Yeah, that's a really, really good question. And I have focused relentlessly over the past couple of years to living core values inside of the business. And we hire, fire, and promote based on those core values. And those core values trump any individual KPI in the business. And we know that if we, as a team, collectively live those core values, that we will grow the business, we will grow our top line, our bottom line, our innovation, our brand presence, our brand equity, all of those things will follow adherence to core values. And because the core values are designed in such a way where if the business is not growing, if the business is struggling, it's because we're not all in, which is one of our core values, or we're not resourceful, which is another, or we aren't professionally learning, which is another. So that's how I've approached it. And it's really hard. It's way harder than I thought it would be.
Yeah.
But we also have really great people, and people who believed in those things. And what those things were, the core values were actually just defining ourselves. We already were those things. We already behaved in that way. We worked in that way. And it was just finding those, the best in ourselves, and defining it and putting it in front of everybody and saying, think about this every day. And so when we do that, we succeed. If we don't, or if someone on the team isn't, then there's always problems.
Yeah. Well, I love that. I love that that's the emphasis, because it is hard, right? Especially when you're kind of the judgment is in the numbers, right? In the performance. And I think this is probably true as well in your space, Ashley, where, you know, when you're training, maybe even there are certain numbers that you're trying to hit, or somebody wants you to hit, I don't know. And then how do you, right, kind of keep that balance, kind of stay at that seven where you are passionate about hitting the numbers, but, you know, you're realizing that, okay, well, the more important part is, okay, my role in the sport or my impact in the sport, like on a day-to-day level, how does that look like for you when you're training?
Yeah, we have the same like KPI sort of things in athletics. And I think this kind of goes back to the perspective idea. You have what you want to do in a day. You have what you want to do in a camp, which is like a 3-week block, in a competition, in a season, a winter or a summer, in a year, in a 4-year. Like we look out for about 4 years, like our 4-year quad cycles with the Olympics. And I think for athletes, it's shifting those perspectives every day. It's using the 4-year motivation to get the today done. I'm doing today for the 4 years. And it's also going back and being like, oh, well, if I want to get the 4 days, I got to do today. So it's being able to use both perspectives constantly to motivate you and get what needs to get done. Because there are the days where you don't want to get up and you just have to, because, you know, it's China's doing it. A Chinese athlete's doing it today. A Russian athlete's doing it today. And if you're not, like, you're not going to get those 4-year long-term goals. And we're constantly evaluating those. Like, you know, your 4-year goal might be different next year. And so being able to take today's goals and, you know, maybe changing them and shifting them for the month and the month goals, like, you have to be able to kind of adapt and change those goals for the better, or sometimes for the worse, because you don't hit those objectives. But you also sometimes, because you're so diligent in the day-to-day goals, I mean, the 4-year goals are way too low and you got to, you know, really ramp those up. But being able to shift those perspectives again is like one of the greatest tools.
Yeah. Well, and I love that the reminder that it's okay if the goal organically changes, right? And just kind of grow with you, because if you hit it, if you're now beyond it, that's, you know, then we got to up it. You know, if you're below it, then okay, well, what should we do to kind of maintain that? I was wondering if maybe you can expand a little bit on, because we talked earlier about the daddy, and I'm sure a lot of the audience who's listening, they're curious about the process that that you undertook really to nail this move, right? Mm-hmm. And was that a 4-year thing? Did you start in, I don't know, in water? Like, did you start, like, what was, can you deconstruct that a little bit for people who are curious?
Might've been an 8-year long plan. That was a big one. But yeah, again, our sports progression. So we do flips on skis, and we train all summer long into a pool. And every summer, everyone starts back off the basics. You start doing single backflips, and you work on your takeoff, and you be straight as possible, and you do however many it takes in order to be, like, done with that trick. And then you move on and you add twists and you keep going until you're doing doubles and triples. And for each athlete, how long you stay on each of those tricks changes every year. So once you're, like, you know, doing triple backflips on snow, those, you know, little progressions happen faster, but you still work through them every year, which is kind of interesting. You know, we have to do thousands of jumps on water before we're up at that position of doing a full double full full. So I guess the same thing happens every year. You just get better at doing it, and then you can add, you know, more icing on the cake every year towards the end of that season.
Right. So very kind of taking it granular, right? And mm-hmm. just kind of step by step by step. So is it something that I know that a lot of people, when they're training and they want a specific result, sometimes they create a certain methodology that's just specific for what they're trying to achieve. And that might be very creatively, I don't know, creating their own ramp, or I don't know, whatever it is. But I've heard that people do this, and I'm curious to hear whether that's something that you've thought about, done, you know, or maybe you've kind of tried and be like, no, we're just going to stick to just kind of the mainstream way of doing it.
I think volume changes is one of the big ways that each athlete kind of gets their own rhythm. And by volume changes, I mean, like, how many jumps do you do in a day, in a week, in a month? And what does that look like? What is your, like, quality to quantity ratio? And, like, how do you get that done? Because I have a different volume take than, like, some of the other athletes. And that shifts throughout your career as well. I do one session a day, and there's some athletes that do two. And because they have to get those numbers. And I have to switch now that I only need 10 jumps, but they are all going to be good. Like if I'm having a bad day, I just, you know, there's different protocols for me. I don't necessarily work through all of the really tough days, because it just doesn't make sense for me. Whereas other athletes, and they just have to do as many numbers as they possibly can. So I think those volume shifts are really big for each athlete.
Right. So just kind of the reps, right? Focusing on, mm-hmm. okay, how many are we doing and all that. Well, and I'm kind of curious, speaking of reps, you know, Mark, I think I was kind of curious about, because we touched a little bit just a second ago about, okay, what does it take to kind of create a team that is both motivated, dedicated, but also, you know, feel safe, right? And I think at any point in an entrepreneur's journey, they always have to consider what Ashley was talking about, volume, right? And the size, perhaps, of people that you work with. And Was there, how did you decide for you? I mean, aside from, okay, well, we need one person here, one person there, one person there. What was the process that you kind of undertake when you kind of decide, okay, this is the size that I wanted to have right now, and this is what works? Is it just purely numbers, or is it just purely kind of, okay, well, we'll try one person doing this? And if you can share that with the audience, I think they'd love to hear that.
Yeah, the hiring at the right time is actually really hard. And especially when you're a bootstrapped company, because you know, if I just had XYZ person, then the business could do this next thing, but the revenues might not be there yet to support bringing in that person. And so sometimes you have to take a risk and build the team, knowing that that will result in growth that will then support the team long term. And it's just, it's, there's no clear science behind it because every business is so different. But one thing that we like to do is when we get to a place where our skills and capabilities don't allow us to take the next step, or we get to a place where the volume of work is so great that if we just had one more person, it's going to sort of make everybody's life better. Usually those are the two scenarios that we find ourselves in. Sometimes we'll pull the trigger regardless of numbers and revenue, because that is going to make my leadership team happier and more productive and more creative in the long term. And so we will occasionally hire based on those needs, knowing that those hires may not actually add revenue to the business, but they will add a higher ceiling in general, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and I think it is interesting when, you know, the team is at a certain size and everybody's in charge, they have different hats, but it's even more interesting once the team gets to a different size and multiple people are wearing the same hats, right? And what does that look like when you are sharing responsibilities or perhaps competing or whatever that is? I think that gets very interesting. But I wanted to touch real quick on, you know, just kind of the idea of competition and how to kind of approach people who are in your space who are perhaps just as good as you, perhaps somebody that you know, or perhaps people who used to be part of your team and then went off to do their own thing. And Ashley, I'm curious to hear, what's it like in terms of your, I guess, team culture, right? How do you guys cultivate that? How do you guys keep everyone kind of have that shared spirit, but also have that competitive edge?
Yeah, our sport does a really good job of making sure that no one gets too confident, cocky after they maybe win an event, just because of the inherent fear in our sport and just the, you know, the risk levels and the amount that we actually crash. The person that wins one week, you know, can crash the next week and be dead last. So that helps. And I also think that you build respect between everyone when you see everyone else working equally hard. Like when I know that my teammates have put in the same like level of dedication and they've gone through the ups and downs just like I have, when they do well, I'm like genuinely happy for them. I'm mad at myself when I don't do well. But I know what it takes. So like there's respect there. And so when you have a big team like that and everyone, you know, sees that and understands that, I think it's really easy to let competition just be a good thing, and not get too caught up in, I got to beat them. I don't know. That doesn't necessarily really happen in aerials, where I did see that a lot, you know, in some other sports that I participated in. And that might just be a testament to the age of the athletes and just, you know, this is our life. And we're in it day in and day out.
Yeah. And I wonder if, and you can kind of see this too, like, right, when somebody wins something or somebody loses something, you see like the teammates just kind of huddle, and they're all in it. But I am kind of curious because so often, like, you know, we fail publicly, right? And this is true. Yeah, Ashley's like, yep.
All the time.
Well, and it's true in every domain. Like there's so, I think particularly like Mark can probably attest too with, you know, the wire fraud thing. Like when you kind of, sometimes things happen and everyone's watching, right? So, Ashley, for you, like, for instance, when you have to take a loss and you knew that you had, you know, done everything that you could, right? And you've hustled and grind and all that thing, all the things. And then it just didn't happen, right? I think this probably touches back on your perspective thing, but what was that first 24 hours like for you after something like that happens? You know, I know, like I was talking to a U.S. Air Force pilot who got demoted at one point, right? And he kind of now carried like a different jet that wasn't as prestigious as the earlier jet that he was supposed to fly. And he said that he took a whole day just doing nothing, unplugging. So I'm kind of curious for you what that, you know, again, that first day or week might look like for you. Do you just kind of relax? Do you kind of go back right into training? What's that like for you?
Yeah, you know, I touched on earlier that like I give myself until I swim to the edge of the pool or I get to the edge of the like ski run or whatever to like be emotionally attached. And that's in training. But you know, when a comp day happens and like you only get so many comps in the year and all these training days add up and like that's why you're here, is for this competition day. So those emotions are impossible to contain just in the next few seconds. And if I didn't have those emotions, I'd be a little bit worried about like, why am I out here doing this? Like, what's my passion for? So those emotions stick. I would say about a day. That's how long, you know, the mess ups, stick around in my head. And I don't think that's necessarily bad. Usually I'm not jumping the next day after competition. We always have a day off. It's a bitter learning experience, I guess, is like, if you're replaying the mistakes in your head all the time, it is hard. And maybe it's doesn't seem necessarily productive at the time, just be hard on yourself, but it's also, you're learning. When you go replay that 1,000 times in your head, what I did wrong, you're a little bit less likely to do it again. There are instances where they're totally out of your control. We do an outdoor sport, so the wind is a huge variable. You could get a bad gust of wind. And for me, I was out for a season because of a bad gust of wind. And those are the bitterest pills to swallow because there's just really nothing you can have done about it. And that's, again, the perspective shift. And when those things happen, season ending, crashes, stuff like that, it's like, I got to get better and I got to be ready for next year. And it's very tough to do. But again, a learning experience. I learned just as much going through ACL rehab as I have winning world championships. One was a little bit more fun.
Well, and I wonder if, you know, I think you were saying with taking that time that, you know, you feel are comfortable for you and works for you. And I can imagine that being an athlete at your level with you traveling all the time, right? All these time changes, different foods, right? Different diets, not being in the comforts of your own home or whatever. It can take a toll on your body when in fact the body is the machine that you're relying on. And I think that's true as well. And I'm going to get to you, Mark, in a minute. You know, people who are very high achievers, they want to really perform at this high level, but because of what they do, sometimes, you know, it eats away certain things that is actually necessary for the body, right? And it's just kind of this catch 22. So for you, like, what are some must haves that for you is a priority? And a lot of the audience, lots of them love this topic on, okay, what do you exactly do on a day to day that you just won't miss? Is it like a walk? Is it a run? Is it like, you know, sleep 8 hours for you, Ashley? And then I'm going to go to you, Mark, in just a second.
I think it's finding a combination of things to make sure you get 75% of them. I think, you know, as a professional athlete, I need a certain amount of water. I need a certain amount of sleep. I need this, need that. But again, the superstitious kind of rule comes in. And if you don't get that, are you really going to fail? Like, I think there's no athlete out there that comes out every day or even on comp day and is 100%. There's just like, this just doesn't happen. like if I'm at 75%, like that's, oh yeah, I'm ready to go. And I think having that in your mind to be like, okay, I got like these 10 things. If I get 7 of these, like this is going to be a good day. Cause you're not going to get all 10. It's just not going to happen. Especially when you're training abroad. There's going to be days where you don't get any good food. Just tough. Like, I don't know what to tell you. And to be ready for those things and making sure that you can rely on some other things to make sure that you can still get to that 75% level that you need to really be at your peak. Like the idea that you're going to be 110% on comp day is just, it's crazy. It's ludicrous. And people shouldn't expect that. But if you have enough things in you to like get where you need to go when certain things are lacking, then you can still have the performance that you're expecting.
Awesome. I love this. And what about you, Mark? Like for you running this machine now, right? 6 years in, have your approach to like daily, I don't know, habits or routines changed? And what are some things that for you now you're like, okay, this is a must have. I'm going to have whatever it is, an hour of Netflix at night or whatever, go out hiking on Saturday. What was that? What would that be for you?
Yeah, I actually frequently will go hiking or skiing on like a random Tuesday morning or a time where it's a purposeful disconnect from a time I should be working to get away and to have, it usually involves sweating. So in the summertime, I'm going to be on a 2-hour bike ride or a 4-hour hike. And because when you start to work, and Ashley can attest to this, when you start to get into a physical challenge, your mind clears up. Because there's really not a lot to focus on besides just the physical task at hand. And some of my ideas will come once I'm tired from doing that, you know, on the way back down from the hike, all of a sudden I can think really clearly about a problem or an opportunity or a branding idea or a campaign or something. And so I do that fairly regularly. We disconnect. And it's actually something that's part of our management plan where we ask the leadership team to do that and to schedule it in. I also think that physical activity daily, even though, you know, we're not athletes, it still is important. And so most of my days include that. And also I try to eat well. I mean, it's really not that much different than like, the intensity is different, but athletes rely on their bodies for performance, and business leaders, it's much more of a mental thing. But if your body's not right, your mind can't be right either. So those are just, you know, maybe a few examples of things that I do.
Yeah, I'd say I do the opposite. I take the physical out and I go to mental.
Yeah, because you work as physical.
I'm so tired. I'm like, but I need to go like use a different part of me. I got to go read a book. I got to go play guitar. I have to go meditate. I have to do something else that's like the opposite. So yeah. That's really funny.
Yeah. Well, because your work is physical, right? So whatever it is that you're doing, you got to do the whatever it is that you don't normally do, right? Which is
A lot of balance.
Yeah, for sure. Now, Mark, you mentioned you like taking hikes, right? And you like kind of climbing and mountaineering and all this good stuff. What is your favorite spot that you've ever visited? Could be a trail, could be like a peak, could be lake somewhere in the US or otherwise. And I'm going to ask a similar question to you, Ashley, in just a sec.
So this is really hard for me to answer because I've climbed a lot of mountains and they have different memories for me and different meanings. I think one of the most like existential experiences I've ever had was summiting Kilimanjaro. It's just, you know, it's pretty spectacular to be at that altitude at sunrise, and I had not experienced that before. But I live along the Wasatch Mountain Range, and I have a lot of peaks in my backyard that are close to my heart that I climb all the time. And that familiarity and that connection, is hard to explain, but it's just, it's your world. It's where you feel you belong. And so, I think those two things. But the last thing I'll throw in there, the prettiest place I've ever hiked is Vancouver Island on the West Coast Trail. And that's more like rainforest and sand than altitude, but every bit is difficult because of the humidity. And carrying a 50-pound pack through sand can be, and mud and slippery jungle, basically, well, rainforest. But yeah, I just love it. It's hard for me to, you know, they're all close to my heart and to who I am. So hard to single out those, but those are just some that come to mind.
I would say it's equally challenging for me. I've been very fortunate to travel the world. So I've seen a lot of really incredible places, also some bad places. But I think what's exhilarating is seeing those new places and getting out. And I don't know if I could narrow that down. That's very, yeah. Very challenging.
Yeah, all great experience. Well, with that, you guys, we are actually out of time. And I want to thank both of you guys for being on. This had been super fun. And I love this conversation. I'm sure the audience loved it as well. And with that said, thanks, guys, for being on the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
You guys, be sure to hit follow, subscribe, add, or collect. Let's dive in.